just trying to change the world here, people.
Oh, really?
Facebooking and the tweeting and the Instagramming, all that would not exist without our understanding of science.
So it's amazing that even as an insult.
You mean true for you is different from true for anybody else?
Have yeah,
to
absolutely, because I can't
think either got to be true or not.
I can't, no.
Welcome to O'Reilly Radio 115A, recorded Friday, June 24th, 2016, where we dismantle the current events for your edutainment through mostly rational conversations that make you go, oh, really? I'm your host, Andy Cowan, and I have my usual suspect, Daniel Atherton, right below me if you're watching the video.
Ew.
And I've got pre-recorded segments from our correspondents, David O'Connor, Fred Sims with his history segment, and Stephen Griffith with an analysis, which is shorter than last week's analysis. By a margin of 2.
Oh.
Actually, more a margin of 3. So, yeah, instead of 15 minutes, it's only 5-ish. Somewhere in there. So, I promised that we were going to talk about gun control this week. I'm sorry about that. Because I'm going to keep the promise, and we're actually going to talk about gun control this week. We've had so many mass shootings. We've talked about what mass shootings are in this country and what that actually means, whether it be a killing spree or anything like that. The media would like every mass shooting, every shooting that involves, I don't know, more than 2 people, you know, more than 2 casualties to be considered a mass shooting. If that's the case, then I believe we're at 1,000 since,
more.
You know, yeah. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. The problem is that, it's the Second Amendment. Technically, that's the problem here. Because otherwise, we'd actually probably have some form of gun control already. But it's by our rights that, you know, as codified into the Constitution, that we're allowed to carry guns. In fact, it's our inalienable right, kind of thing. Or at least that's what they would like us to believe. And by them, I mean the people that really have a vested interest in gun sales. Or they somehow find that the gun is, I don't know, an extension of their own being. You know, some... Let me also backpedal one sec. Guns are fun. Going out shooting is a fun thing to do. It's a little scary the first couple times because, you know, it's an explosion in your hand that throws a little chunk of metal downrange somewhere, and if you're good, or even relatively good, you put a hole in a target, and that's gratifying. To have made a success. That's gratifying. It puts our little lizard brains into little high gear. And it's like, yay, I did something. I did something good. But that's, let's be honest, it's designed to kill things.
Yeah.
And do we need to kill things anymore? I mean, of course, then we get into the big ethics conversation about killing anything. Which we don't need to do right now, because I like meat. I know that there is an ethical quandary there, because I also don't like to kill things. And if I had to go pluck a chicken, you know, on my own, if I had to go, you know, cut the head off and drain it and pluck it and do everything, I'm not really inclined to do that. I don't even like going fishing and filleting a fish. That's not really my thing either. But when it gets, you know, to the higher level things like a cow, I love some beef. But I'm not going to be the one to kill the cow. I'm not going to be the killer or the butcher or any of that. That's not me. So, one of these days, I may become a vegetarian. I might. I don't know. The thing is, it's kind of expensive to actually eat well. Without a high protein diet in this country. It's really difficult. You know, you can go get 10 McNuggets. I'm sorry, not McNuggets, because I'm thinking Burger King for $1.50. Now, certainly, you could argue that that's not really chicken. You could argue that, but it's meat. You know, that's the thing. It is a protein derived from an animal. And it is insanely cheap for us consumers. Now, for the environment and all those things, it's a huge issue. Huge issue. But that's not what the show is. I just wanted to point out that there are ethical quandaries here in taking the life of anything that has even a modicum of self-preservation desire. You know, no animal wants to be killed. Let's look at it that way. Evolution has kind of set them up to want to thrive and survive, you know, to propagate their genes. It's a thing, you know. So to willingly go and do that is kind of a problem, ethically. We separate ourselves from it by going through the grocery aisle and seeing it all pre-packed for us. That's just a commodity product. That's not an animal anymore. So we've separated ourselves from it. So, be that as it may, when we graduate from what we consider animals to what we consider people, individuals, then again, I'm not the person that's going to go out and kill somebody. I don't want to do that. Yeah, that people might think that, you know, my atheism means that I can go do things, you know, whatever I want. And I do. I do exactly much murdering as I want, which is zero. I have no desire to do things like that. And most normal people, you know, again, you know, we can mince words all we want, and that's going to be a large part of the show, is going to be mincing words. Most people that are in the normal spectrum of people that you want to be around normally don't want to kill other people. There are the abnormal people that are very willing to kill other people. And usually steal their stuff. Maybe steal their stuff, and then consequently kill you in order to get it. Yeah. Then we get into the fear of those people. Those people probably have guns, because it makes killing people easier. It's a big threatening thing. It is very efficient at what it does, which is, again, throw kinetically a small chunk of metal far away from the person with the gun, usually into a target. When it's not a paper target, it's an animal target. We are animals in that case. And it's designed to kill us. There's no two ways to look at that. It's designed to kill you. I mean, feel free and step in here if I go off course.
No, it's an instrument that is designed to kill.
Can you maim somebody? Sure, you can aim for kneecaps. Absolutely.
But it's easier to aim for kneecaps with, say, you know, go back to any of the blade cultures. It's easier to aim for the knee with a long sword than it is with any form of firearm. You have to have a great deal of control as well as anticipation of your target's movements to hit something so small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, then we get into, you know, the whole weapons culture as a whole. But for this, we're just going to talk about firearms, really. You know, gun control in general. The big conversation that brought all this on, of course, was the Orlando Pulse shooting, which has been conflated as being an assault rifle. Doesn't really matter. Yeah. And also, the reason why we're talking about this now is because the gun control issue is not even a thing with that case, because he had them legally. He had the guns legally, he had the permits. The only thing that he wasn't able to really acquire was body armor near the end. And had he really premeditated it ahead of time, in a big fashion, he would have been able to get it. He would have been able to have it.
he would have had before he went on the rampage, yes.
Yeah. It's all a matter of timing. And for the truly dedicated person, the one that really wants to make the most damage, they've got the patience to do it. You know, like the Oklahoma City bombing. That took some time to organize.
Acquiring that much info over time.
Yeah. It takes time to do things like that.
Fertilizer, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, fertilizer is controlled. Mm-hmm. It's something that you can only buy so much of in a month. It's tracked by the government.
Why is that?
Because it can blow people up.
Oh. Was that always a thing, or did that only happen after they blew somebody up?
I believe that was a thing before the Oklahoma incident. That was part of the reason they were able to track it.
Okay. And then, you know, we've had many cases where somebody has done something wrong, like using a box cutter to try and take over a plane.
Or running a plane into a building.
Right. So now, whenever we go to the airport, we have to almost get a cavity search. At the very least, we have to have people, you know, put us through x-ray machines where they get to watch all of our genitals. And then if that's not good enough, then they get to feel you up. And they still get to throw away the stuff that they don't want you to have.
You don't get to keep it. It doesn't get placed on the plane anywhere at all. It just gets disposed of.
Yeah. Mama Van in the chat room is being helpful, and she says, it is now, but that is a result of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Okay.
Farmers used to buy it by the 100-pound bag, no questions asked.
Wow.
And it's fertilizer. For agricultural purposes, that's what you're going to do with it.
But it's now tracked, and you are limited because of some psychopath.
Right. And we're being, you know, body searched and having all of our stuff gone through, and we, you know, all these
because massive for everything things. Else, we regulate for the lowest common denominator.
Right. Except
you
for
are
guns.
Licensed to own a vehicle and operate it. It is, again, my father was a homicide detective. But before I started even thinking about learning to drive, we had the conversation that sitting in the car, this is a weapon. Don't let anyone else lie to you. A vehicle is a weapon.
It is a missile.
It can be used to create vast amounts of destruction. Mm-hmm. It can kill people, other people as well as yourself. And that's why you have to be licensed to own and operate one.
Mm-hmm. And insured.
And insured.
At least in some states. In the state of Florida, it's required.
But that's for a car. Something that we use every day. Something that's part ubiquitous part of our lives here in the states because we don't really do public transit well.
Yeah. It's something that's... It's funny because it is a privilege, not a right. Like, apparently owning guns is a right. But it's a right that can be taken away if you commit a crime. Everything in this country can be taken away, if including your right to vote.
Yeah.
Your right to due process. All these things, they can be taken away. So, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't mean anything. Not really. Other than it's a giant talking point for the NRA. And they make an awful lot of money.
Tons.
Fear sells. Fear motivates people. Motivates people to buy things to staunch their fear. So people that feel truly helpless... And that's a lot of people in this country and around the world. People that feel really helpless want anything to make them feel like they have a little control over their lives. And if they feel that they're being stepped on by a tyrannical government, or they have to protect themselves from an existential threat such as terrorism, or insert ethnic group here that's going to come and take their jobs and rights and maybe their daughters and everybody else. Insert fear group here, whoever you want to hate, the hate du jour, if you will, and you have a recipe that sells whatever you happen to have. And in the case of weapons, of guns, then you build an entire culture around it. We have an entire culture, a gun culture. And I'm not the first one to coin these terms. They exist.
No. And I think this is a point Steve may point out, but I'll do it ahead of time.
Go ahead. We'll break into their videos here in a minute.
America, I believe, is unique in this, that when we look to our brethren across the world, they started out with other weapons being the ancestral weapon of that culture. America is one of the unique ones in which the gun was our ancestral weapon.
Yeah. The musket. You know, the Civil War, the musket, you know, all that.
And then we have Western expansion. The Winchester rifle.
Yeah.
The gun that won the West.
The Red Ryder BB gun.
Again,
we get our kids in on it real early.
We are a gun culture. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, that we have and sell guns here. No, it's ingrained. I mean, go back to radio. Back before TV, we had the Lone Ranger.
The age-old game of playing cowboys and Indians. Where the cowboys had the guns, the Indians had the bows and arrows. Again, it's fun to shoot things. This is a thing that we learn real early. Hand-eye coordination. Hell, we even celebrate it with Duck Hunt. I mean, yeah, it's a light gun, but still, it's a gun.
No, we have a severe gun culture here. Any action picture out there is, especially Western in style, not just the actual genre Western, is gun-based. And going back to the actual Western genre, Westerns have guns. It's part of what makes it a Western.
Yeah.
And it's in the glorifying and telling of stories in a very specific American era.
Yeah.
And it's one that went on extensively in this country up until really the early 90s. We've had a number of Westerns come out since then, but not with the same amount of viewership, and definitely without the same level of reverence. The last real big Western that we had was Tombstone, which was post Unforgiven, which was the last real blockbuster.
Yeah, Unforgiven was, that was a heck of a movie.
Yeah, it won Oscars.
The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, but that just one recently. Again. Less fanfare, less critical acclaim, less everything. I mean, we have a remake of The Magnificent Seven coming up here shortly. We still make Westerns.
Yeah.
It's still something that we consume as a culture.
Yeah,
it's still there. Trust me, whenever I go and visit my parents, my dad's usually watching reruns of Gunsmoke. All right?
Yeah. My dad has a good collection of the Louis L'Amour, you know, novels. Yeah, all Westerns. Yeah.
It's a part of the American culture.
Yeah.
Is this glorification of heroes with guns. The villains have them too, but it's heroes with guns.
That is the way of it. That is the way of it. Now, to give you... give our audience an idea. Go out to our webpage. You should go out to our webpage anyway. OReallyRadio.com. I've got a search bar there. Type in guns and hit enter. we have been talking about guns, or at least I've been talking about guns, in some form or another on this program since before it began. I imported the blog that I used to do, which was, Can We Fix It? I imported that over, and that was all, you know, Topic Tuesday posts, you know, whatever happened to be topical at the time. There's a staggering number of those that are on guns and gun culture and, you know, whatever the shooting of the day happened to be. It's a staggering number. I didn't bother to count, but there was a couple pages of it. Now, one in particular, and it goes along with the whole gun culture thing. The highest downloaded, the highest linked to page on A Really Radio is Topic Tuesday number 98. Guns, lots of guns. That is what people are searching for. This comes up all the time in search histories. That's what Google sends people to my webpage for. I don't know why. I mean, sure, it's a well-documented article. I'm very proud of it, of course. You know, it's like choosing one of your children, you know.
But when you type, when somebody just types into Google, lots of guns,
yeah,
they may stumble upon your Or Really Radio site for that specific article.
Yeah. And it is right here. You know, and so you can go see it. I'm gonna read a little bit of it, because it.
I need to point something out.
This was in 2014.
Yeah, this was.
It's all the same.
Yeah, this was 2014. It's 2 years later, folks.
Yeah.
We're still having the same conversation.
It is no less relevant. No less relevant at all.
Because nothing's happened. Nothing's happened towards bringing this under control for longer than 2 years, but for at least 2 years.
Yep. How do we speak rationally to all parties about the topic of guns? You know, this is still a problem, but that's how I start off the article in 2014. This is a tough one, as no matter what side of the argument you talk about, you're going to deeply offend someone. Let me start by saying that it is far from my intention. I believe I backpedaled on that even this time. You know, again, things never change, do they? So please, you know, no matter how strong you fall away, anyway, gun violence is an issue. Gun control is an issue. I think that is something that we can agree to. You know, over the course of time, that has been the case. So as I, what was I even talking about here? Oh yeah, okay. I was a weapons master in college and taught gun safety to those that had never held a firearm before. These were props and had to be handled with the utmost care. As you'll recall, Brandon Lee was killed when a firearm was mishandled on the movie set for The Crow. Accidents happen even to those that are highly trained. That said, there are many that are not highly trained that are handling their own weapons incorrectly. You cannot peruse the news without coming to at least one story involving a firearm discharge or the threat of its use interwoven with a story. Remember, a threat constitutes assault, while physical violence represents battery in an assault and battery charge. We have a certain expectation as a polite society that we can walk about and not be threatened or physically harmed. Unless you are particularly paranoid and believe the world is out to get you, you should see this pretty clearly. We also have a certain expectation as legally set in our beloved Constitution. For clarity, I will append the Second Amendment as ratified on display at the National Archives right here. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed, period. I would like to point out that the Second Amendment is a single run-on sentence. It is one sentence. And that is what people are hinging their entire arguments on. There have been massive debates on the comma placement and what that means.
Yep.
It's irrelevant. I mean, it's a clause inside. You know, it's to take out this and say, this is what we mean by this. It's a clarifying statement. You know, for those English majors out there, that's kind of what it does. So, a well-regulated militia. Militia is capitalized, therefore it is a proper noun. It is a thing. Being necessary to the security of a free state. I believe, actually, state is actually supposed to be capitalized, too. Yeah, it is capitalized. So, state is another entity. So, saying that the militia is a property of the state and is necessary for the state. Right?
Yeah. The right of the people to keep and bear arms. Arms is capitalized.
As a proper thing. Weapons.
Shall not be infringed. And I believe infringed is capitalized?
No. Infringed is not capitalized. That just happens to be where the dot is.
But, okay. So the militia, being necessary to the state, they need arms.
For the security of the state, not the individual. At no point does this say that it's for the individual's security.
No, it's for the state's security.
It is for the state's security.
And you know what? We've got a National Guard.
We have a National Guard. Guns. We have police. We have we have a Coast Guard. We have a Navy. We have an Air Force. We have we have the Army. We have the Marines.
We have all these things that the framers of the Constitution did not see as being a full-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
When they were fighting for the Revolution, an army was called up. It was pulled from different revolutionaries and people who were willing to fight and die. Some of them just joined on to get paid, or possibly their freedom, as in a lot of African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, some freed slaves, some not. Some fought in place of their owners.
Yeah. In some cases, that was what was done. So, just to carry on with this, because, you know, again, we could belabor the point of commas just as well as anyone else could. But I am, at best, a hobbyist when it comes to history and the law. Okay? So, I have no professional interest in this other than as a pundit and as a person that does not wish to be shot. So I do have a vested interest, at least, because I do not wish bodily harm upon myself or others. You know, I am a parent. I want my children to be happy and safe. And Sandy Hook, of course, hit me rather close to home as I had young children. They are in elementary school now. You know, nowhere is safe.
Nowhere fear, is safe, fear, fear, nowhere fear, is fear. Sacred.
Yeah. And usually in this country, it's think of the children. So obviously we're going to immediately do something because the children were affected.
No.
But we did nothing. Because what was the argument? It's not the right time. We can't talk about that now. It's too close to it. No. We have to let the grieving process happen.
Was it too close to pass the Patriot Act?
There's never a good time. There's never a good time to talk about it. But there's always a good time to talk about other things. Yeah. So.
Snap of the fingers.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Now, I go on to indicate some other things here. The National Firearms Act of 1934. Written with the help of the NRA. This law regulates the transfer of a particular class of weapon known as a Title II weapon. Title II weapons include machine guns, certain parts of machine guns, short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns, silencers, and destructive devices such as grenades or mortars. Title II weapons also include a category called any other weapon. This is a generic term used to describe a concealable weapon that can shoot, but does not quite fit into any other category. An example of any other weapon would be a cane gun or a pen gun.
which most pen guns are illegal.
Yeah. The fee is $200. Yeah.
But back when that that law was written, $200 was a good chunk of money.
Yep. 1934. Remember,
this was in response to the Roaring Twenties, folks.
Yeah. There are four key laws here that I go through.
But this law was passed back, you know, in a time of runners, they realized that people having machine guns and shooting up the place and shooting at law enforcement and civilians and other bad guys was a bad time for everybody.
Yeah.
So let's regulate that.
Yeah, the Tommy gun. An icon of the old gun mall days, you know? Okay, so moving forward in history to 1968, the Gun Control Act, GCA. Gun Control Act has the broadest reach of any federal gun control law as it pertains to the state or transfer of any firearm and ammunition. This act establishes the Federal Firearms License, the FFL, system, which requires gun dealers to be licensed and prohibits interstate gun sales by anyone other than a licensed dealer. The GCA also made it unlawful for certain people to purchase firearms. These prohibited persons include anyone currently under indictment for a crime punishable by more than a year in prison, anyone who has been previously convicted of such a crime, fugitives, shocking on that one, users of any controlled substance.
Now that's an interesting
any one. Controlled substance. That's prescription medication.
Yeah.
Anyone who has been committed to a mental institution or deemed mentally defective. Obviously, the terms are of a era, 1968. So, illegal aliens. Anyone who has been dishonorably discharged from the military. Anyone who has renounced his or her U.S. citizenship. Anyone who currently has a restraining order against him or her from an intimate partner or child of said partner. Anyone who has been convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor. There are several people that are listening to the show right now that are angry, very, very angry that certain people still have their guns. You know, just because of things like that, it's illegal for them to have them by the Gun Control Act of 1968, which, to my knowledge, has not been repealed and is still in effect.
And is not being enforced.
And is not being enforced at all. Now, two more. Firearm Owners Protection Act of 1986, FOPA. Well, that's a great acronym. The Firearm Owner Protection Act was enacted to make changes to the Gun Control Act of 1968. One of the most notable changes banned civilian ownership of machine guns that were manufactured and registered after May 19th, 1986. The act also introduced the Safe Passage provision. This provision protects gun owners who are traveling through a state from being prosecuted for breaking that state's gun laws under certain conditions. The gun owner must not spend any extended time in the state and must have his or her firearms unloaded and stored in a separate compartment, such as a trunk or a lockbox. Before this change to the GCA, a dealer was defined as someone, quote, engaged in the business, end quote, of selling firearms. Under FOPA, the definition was modified to specify that a dealer must be selling firearms for profit or livelihood. This allows unlicensed individuals to sell firearms from their private collection without performing a background check on the buyer. This change created what has become known as the gun show loophole. The GCA still requires that guns not be sold to a prohibited person, but without a background check, it may be impossible to determine if a buyer is prohibited. Now, when you buy a gun, there is a serial number on the gun. I don't care if it's a handgun. I don't care if it's a rifle. I don't care if it's an assault weapon. I don't care if it's a bazooka. If you can somehow manage to obtain a bazooka, it's got a serial number. Okay? That goes in the file with the information that you provided to the selling agent. If you bought it through, what was it? Someone
a that, licensed
that
gun
is engaged in the business of selling firearms.
Well, now it's engaged in selling of firearms for profit or livelihood.
Right. So that information goes with the gun and is filed with the gun. Nothing. This allows you legally to sell a firearm that you obtained legally to any Joe Schmo out of the trunk of your car for cash.
And no one has to be notified.
There is no notification required to anyone. Now, if you then go to, you know, sell or pawn the weapon that you then bought from whoever in the back of a car in a back alley somewhere, or in the middle of a parking lot, whatever, it can be broad daylight. It's a legal transaction, so it doesn't make any difference. Though, I imagine after a certain point, you would probably have to pay tax on it. You know, something like that, depending. Anyway, that's another issue. You know, since Al Capone went down by with the IRS, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's an option.
Accountants seem to be the most, you know, able-bodied individuals when it comes to the prosecution of crime in this country.
Because it's all about follow the money. See, it's all follow the money. It's the motto for the show, I swear. So with this, they could then, they'll look up the serial number and then they'll ask you. It's like, you're not so-and-so. How did you get this gun? But if you just sell it to another Joe Schmo, it's legal too. You know, you can become a collector and no one will know the difference. Or that gun could fall into the wrong hands or be stolen from you. And though you really ought to report it, nothing requires you to report that a weapon that you bought from a guy in the back of a car that was stolen, nothing requires you to report that legally. Because no one knows you have it. Because no one's following this. The gun show loophole exists. It still exists. It has not been closed. As of today, right now. So, then we fast forward a little bit more to 1994. This is the last, and then we'll move on to our other contributors. The Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act of 1994. The Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act requires that federally licensed dealers conduct background checks on any individual who purchases a weapon from them. The background check is to determine if the individual is a prohibited person, as stated in the GCA. The act does not circumvent the gun show loophole, provided the seller is not in the business of selling guns. So, in addition, federally licensed collectors of curio and relic firearms do not have to undergo a background check when purchasing a curio and relic gun. This would be where people can own bazookas, by the way, as a relic, as a curio. Because you can also be, you can spend that $200 license fee and be a collector of
Title II weapons.
Cannons, if you like. Title II weapons, yeah. So some states have more stricter laws and things like that, and you know, your municipality may vary greatly. But those four laws, the National Firearms Act of 1934, the Gun Control Act of 1968, the Firearm Owners Protection Act, which introduced the gun show loophole, and the Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act, those are the federal laws that are important for you. And note that the Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act.
Yeah.
Now, technically, though it says handgun, it does not indicate that it's only handguns. It's just firearms. And it affects dealers.
Yeah.
It makes dealers of firearms have to go through the background check process.
But not individuals who are selling to another random individual, even though that they are not in the business
right.
of selling firearms.
Right.
But we have all these gun shows that tour across the country.
Yeah.
I know we have gun shows that tour across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are making money off these gun shows who are not licensed dealers of guns.
Yeah.
So aren't they making a living off of selling firearms?
Well, then you have to deal with the accountants again and see whether or not they are making a substantial portion of their income on it to see whether or not it is other than a hobby.
But what constitutes significant portion? What percentage?
There are laws in place for income based on hobbies. So if you have a primary income that is not that, then you're not in the business of that. It's a hobby.
So I'm just curious as to how much you need to make above
okay.
what you're making selling guns.
IRS hobby income. Five basic tax tips about hobbies. Thanks to the IRS.gov. Let's see. A key feature of a business, make a profit. You often engage in a hobby. There is a whole publication, Publication 535. Allowable hobby deductions, limits on hobby expenses, how to deduct hobby expenses. Use IRS free file. Ah, if you make $58,000 or less, you can use use brand name tax software. Oh, wait, no, that's for... No, that's still hobby laws. Hobby rules can be complex, and IRS free file can make filing easier. Business or hobby. There we go. Okay, scrolling through here. Again, deductions, exemptions, credit. In order to educate taxpayers regarding their filing obligations. Oh, God, we're going through tax loopholes. If an activity is not for profit, losses from that activity may not be included in offset income. No. Okay. The IRS presumes that an activity is carried on for profit if it makes a profit during at least 3 of the last 5 tax years, including the current year. At least 2 of the last 7 years for activities that consist primarily of breeding, showing, training, or racing horses. So, basically, if you don't make a profit regularly. Essentially regularly, yeah.
So, I could make all this profit for a year.
Yeah.
Then
take not do
a year off.
Well,
do it again.
At least 2 of the last 7 years. Oh, wait, no, that's for the breeding. At least if it makes a profit during at least 3 of the last 5 years. 3 of the last 5.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's a lot of leeway there where somebody can skirt along and not have to file the paperwork because it's technically a hobby. It is not their primary business.
It only has to make a profit three out of 5 years before it becomes not a hobby.
Yeah, then it becomes a business.
So you can do 2 years off, a year on, 2 years off, a year on, and yeah. You're good.
Yeah. So you could be buying in that time.
Yeah. You could be acquiring mm-hmm. to sell in that 1 year.
Yeah. Mama Van points out that a high number of gun show transactions are cash money and therefore not traceable. There's that too. It's the equivalent of selling it out of a trunk in a parking lot. Yeah.
because you don't have to declare it. But there, mm-hmm. you can, for declaring, you can take, you know, 2 years off of declaring. But
yeah.
in one of those years, every 3 years you declare 1 year of sales.
Mm-hmm.
Just to try and keep above board.
Yeah. If you wanted to do so. Yeah. You could do that.
You want to at least make the attempt.
There are accountants out there that are saying, darn, they figured it out.
Well, I'm just going, screw going back to school for economics. Maybe I should go into accounting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you can deal with it. The FBI hires more accountants than anyone else. If that gives you any idea.
Job security.
Oh, yeah.
Folks, if you're looking for job security, go be an accountant.
Yeah. Follow the money.
All the money, then you get to count the money.
Count the money.
But no, this is insane, folks. We're the only first world country that does this nonsense.
Speaking of that, we have some contributors, and we ought to let them talk so that we can stop talking for a bit.
Yeah.
So let me see here. Let's
enjoy their wisdom and rants.
Who shall we bring up first?
Let's not pull the trigger on the gun just yet.
Okay.
Let's do Fred. Let's have Fred frame things for us with some history.
Okay. All right, Freddy. Not that I would call you that to your face. Come on, interface. There we go. And play.
Good evening, O'Reilly Radio listeners. This is Fred. I'm not able to be here tonight, so I'm going to go ahead and record my history segment, kind of give my take on the Second Amendment talk that's going on for Show A. And basically kind of tie in some history with some thoughts on the current situation as it stands. Now, in order to engage in a proper discussion regarding the Second Amendment, it would be prudent to delve into the history of the amendment itself. And the Second Amendment was based partially on the right to keep and bear arms in English common law, and it was heavily influenced by the English Bill of Rights of 1689. The conversation regarding the vague wording of the Second Amendment has stretched over the course of its existence, with relating Supreme Court cases going as far back as 1876. And one of the biggest points of contention being, who did the Founding Fathers mean to be included? You know, the father right from the aforementioned English Bill of Rights was specific in its exclusion, stating subjects who are Protestants, so Protestants only, may bear arms for their defense as permitted by law. The Second Amendment had the opportunity to be as specific, with early versions going as far as to, you know, define militia and provide a conscientious objector clause within the language. At the time of ratification, the bill was largely uncontroversial, with the only real call for clarification coming from Pennsylvania delegate Robert Whitehall, who pushed for a Bill of Rights explicitly granting individuals the right to hunt on their own land in season. Early debate in the years that followed centered mainly around fears of an overpowered federal government that could disarm its people. Sound familiar? Contentious debate is more of a 20th century issue, and the heaviest blow landed in the 2008 Supreme Court decision in the District of Columbia versus Heller, which through a 5-4 court decision found that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia. This seems to be a rather broad interpretation of the phrase, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is especially so when you consider that in writing the decision for the majority, then Justice Scalia broke down the meaning of the right of the people. Scalia argued that nowhere else in the Constitution does a right afforded the people refer to anything other than an individual right. By this logic, I could not argue with his decision. But what he fails to mention is that also, nowhere else in the Constitution, where a right is afforded to the people, is there a prefatory clause like a well-regulated militia. All other rights are extremely specific in regards to the people, with two being specific down to a person or the accused. And while I disagree with the decision to interpret the Second Amendment as pertaining to an individual's right, especially in the face of incidents like the Pulse nightclub shooting, San Bernardino, and Sandy Hook, I can appreciate that the majority in the Heller Supreme Court case still felt the need to explain that the individual's right to bear arms was not unlimited and states it is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever, in any manner whatsoever, and for whatever purpose. Also upholding the decision in a previous Supreme Court ruling that the sorts of weapons protected are those in common use at the time, and finding support in the historical tradition of prohibiting the carry of dangerous and unusual weapons. Now, due to the sheer volumes available thanks to mass production available today, most weapons would probably not qualify by a loose definition of the term unusual. However, by an equally loose definition of the term dangerous, it could be argued that all firearms fall under such prohibition. The firearms you'll hear most debated recently, and that you'll probably hear discussed throughout this show, such as the AR-15 or the Sig Sauer MCX, should definitely fall under this prohibition. Though in response, the "in common use at the time" clause may be tossed out, as I frequently hear uses for these weapons involving hunting and self-defense. Now, interestingly enough, OutdoorLife.com released a list of the 50 best hunting rifles over the last 10 years. Now, this is a time period that extends beyond the Heller decision and started a full 2 years after the federal ban on assault weapons was lifted. And of those 50 best rifles, only one of them was an AR model. And a Washington Times breakdown of the 21 best guns for home defense likewise listed only one AR-type firearm. Though no shotguns made the list for best home defense, so take that as you will. With so many other best options for both hunting and home defense, I will again pose the question asked so often recently of, does anyone truly need an AR-15, Sig Sauer MCX, or other likened assault rifle? Even a quick, relatively uninformed glance could point you to an answer of no to that question. Outside of loss of money to firearm manufacturers and distributors, there is no good, defensible argument as to why those weapons are necessary with so many other options available that, while still dangerous, are in common use at the time for so many of our country's mass shootings. I will wrap up by leaving you with this thought. Inclusion of the right to keep and bear arms by the people in a written constitution is unusual. Unusual. In 1875, 17% of constitutions included a right to bear arms. Since the early 20th century, the proportion has been less than 10% and falling. Generally, where modern constitutions refer to arms at all, the purpose is to allow the government to regulate their use or to compel military service, not to provide a right to bear them. At present date, out of the world's nearly 200 constitutions, only 3 still include a right to bear arms: Guatemala, Mexico, and the United States. Of those 3, only the last, the good old US of A, does not include explicit restrictive conditions. Think about that. And while you do, please enjoy the rest of the show. Have a great night.
Woo!
Yeah. A lot to unload.
Yeah, so I see what you did there. A lot to unload. Clever. So, 3. We're classed with Guatemala, Mexico.
And us.
That's it. And of those, we're the only ones that don't put any restrictions on it.
Yeah.
Yet we do have several laws on the books, as we've just gone over. That do have some restrictions.
Yeah, but not constitutionally.
Right.
Now, here's the thing that it's kind of just been gnawing at me for a number of years.
Yeah.
We used to have constitutional conventions more often. And then that dropped off. Like, off a cliff.
Where it's untouchable? Where we wouldn't put any more amendments?
We don't hold a constitutional convention anymore. I mean, beforehand, the framers realized, well, this is a good starting point, but there's going to be amendments needed. And we've stopped doing that.
Well, they seem to have lost the point of it being a living document. They want it to remain as... a bug in amber to never be changed.
But that wasn't its intent.
Mama Van, yes, the Brady bill did, but this was a different act that was also brought by Brady. So,
thank you, Mama Van.
Yeah, the Brady bill restricted the sale of high capacity magazines, but it seems that you can still get them. So I don't know.
It's restricted, but not prohibited.
Yeah, that's the deal. Restricted, not prohibited. So, and again,
I mean, we can do an entire show just on how many bullets do you really need.
It depends on what you're doing.
Honestly, in my opinion, the capacity of any magazine held by any civilian should be no more than 5.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, the old 6-shooter. So you could limit it that as a historical throwback. You know.
Sure. But honestly, if you can't hit it in 5, you're not going to hit it.
Pretty much. Yeah. You know, but then people say, well, what am I going to do about that whole gang that's coming at me? Really? Really? That's what you're worried about? You need to move. Thing,
call the phone. Call the police.
Yeah. Or just move. I mean, really? I don't know if the Brady Bill was allowed to lapse. I imagine that it was castrated. If it was anything at all. Let's see. Brady Bill. It was the, I don't think it's the handgun waiting period. That's still in effect. That was its main focus. Or is the Handgun Violence Protection Act actually referred to as the Brady Bill? It is. So that is the Brady Bill. So it's merely a portion of it that does that. There are other provisions, yeah, I thought I probably glossed over that just for the sake of whatever restrictions it was putting on, you know, tailoring it to the argument. But yeah, there is you can go out on Wikipedia and it has a whole big section on provisions. I'm not going to belabor the point, but yeah, the Brady Bill is quite lengthy. Introduced by House of Representatives by Charles E. Schumer in 1993. Passed House, report joint, signed into law by Bill Clinton on November 30th, 1993. It also has, along the side, let me see if I can share this window here. There we go. Along the side, there is a firearm legal topics of the United States, along with, you know, of the Second Amendment being the very first one, assault weapon legislation, ATF, Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act, Campus Carry in the United States, Concealed Carry in the U.S., Connecticut Children's Safety Act, Constitutional Carry, Domestic Violence Offender Gun Ban, Federal Assault Weapon Ban, Federal Firearms Act of 1938, the Federal Firearm License, Firearm Case Law, and on and on and on and on and on and on. We got a lot of laws and a lot of things that legislate guns, but a lot of them, it still allows people to have too many of them. There's, in this country, of more than 300 million people, but less than 350 million, I believe. So in there is a reported number of 4 guns per person currently in circulation. I do not own any.
I do not own any.
My children do not own any.
Everyone that's I live with doesn't own any.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of guns that are in the hands of other people.
There are copious amount of firearms in the hands of others.
Mama Van said that she has quite the arsenal. I'm not going to mess with Mama Van. No, no, no. But she is also in favor of better restrictions. Of better legislation and taking care of this problem.
One of the things that going to the argument I am guessing one of our two rants that we will play soon will go into is Australia.
I imagine that you think Steven's going to say something about Australia?
Maybe.
I don't think David is.
But when they restricted guns, they had a buyback program. No questions asked about where you got the firearm, but they would purchase it off of you. Now, instead of coming for your guns, they bought your guns.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people out there.
It's like eminent domain for guns.
Who are struggling to make ends meet, but have a firearm. I think it would be prudent for some of my tax money to go to people who don't really need that firearm, but could definitely use a decent check. I'm fine with that.
As stated by President Ronald Reagan, March 29th, 1991, the Brady Bill would require the handgun dealer to provide a copy of the prospective purchaser's sworn statement to local law enforcement authorities so that background checks could be made. Based upon the evidence in states that already have handgun purchase waiting periods, this bill, on a nationwide scale, can't help but stop thousands of illegal handgun purchases. Supported.
That was Reagan?
That was supported by President Ronald Reagan.
Again, Reagan, who is practically a saint to the right wing.
Mm-hmm. He also supported the assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
So.
And again, the right love to prop up Reagan as this almost messianic figure. And yet, like their other messianic figure that they like to prop up, they don't seem to listen to a lot of what he says.
Yeah. Speaking of the high-capacity magazine ban, the high-capacity magazine ban is a law which bans or otherwise restricts firearm magazines that can hold more than a certain number of rounds, of course. The now-expired federal assault weapons ban of 1994... included limits regarding magazine that could hold more than 10 rounds. 8 U.S. states and a number of local governments ban or regulate magazines that can have legally defined as that have been legally defined as high capacity. The majority of states, 42 of them, do not ban or regulate any magazine on the basis of capacity.
10 shots.
10 rounds.
Far more generous than I would be.
10 rounds is, no, 10 rounds is, was the limit, right? Yeah. Let's see. So any more than 10. So 11, your high capacity.
Because 10's a nice round number that we can all get our minds around.
Yeah.
We like round numbers. We like fives. We like tens.
Mm-hmm. Most pistols sold in the U.S. are made and sold with magazines holding 10 and 17 rounds.
Why do we need 17 rounds?
Yeah, caseless ammo. Yeah, you can fit 17 in a clip.
Why do we need 17?
Yeah. Now, of course, I'm going to piss people off by going back and forth between what is a magazine and what is a clip. Because you know what? I don't care. It's the thing what hold the bullets that go into gun. So I'm going to use them interchangeably. So go ahead and at least know that I am making a mockery of that. You may now send your email to O'ReillyRadioPodcast@gmail.com. You may also call with a sternly worded voicemail at 470-222-ORLY or 6759 if you don't have the numbers and the letters. Yeah, that's fine too.
And thank you, Mama Man. Yes, Reagan was shot, so he understood why, you know.
Yeah, and so was Jim Brady.
Guns hurt people and kill people.
Yeah. 10-round capacity comes with the 10 to 22. 10 to 22. Yeah, I have a 50-round clip for mine. I can't remember when I have used it. I hope that you never have to use it. Because, you know, One of the other things to consider with this, for a hobbyist shooter, it's a pain in the ass to load them.
Because they have the large magazines? Yeah.
Because they have a really stiff spring in them to make sure that it ejects the rounds properly. So you got to punch them all in. And, you know, you end up with big calluses and you hurt your fingers. You know, I have done this before. Not speaking just as a layman, I have done this before. And it hurts. And it's annoying. And I'm, you know, it's like, I have to go through all this just to go, target
shoot. And here's one of the things, again.
To do it European, for a 50. That's dedication.
Being the European correspondent.
Yeah.
Again, we've established that guns are fun. And people around the world understand guns are fun. You know what people have over in Europe? And some people here in the States do. They have gun clubs. Sort of like car clubs. Where you can go to the club, you have your membership, you can check out a firearm and some rounds, and you can shoot at the club. Or you can go to your favorite range. With some clubs over in Europe, you can check out a gun for the purpose of hunting in season.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And it's checked out. They have a log of who has the firearm, how many rounds they have, and when you're done, you check the firearm and whatever rounds you did not use back in.
There you go. Easy as that, right?
Yeah. You can go have fun without having to own the firearm. There are other clubs also that you own the firearm, but the club is where you keep the firearm.
Yeah. I've seen
there that. There are clubs that work like that.
Yeah. I think you can do that here in the States if you want to have the gun, but you are not inclined to keep it at home for whatever reason. Perhaps your spouse, you know, doesn't want you to have it at home. Perhaps you have children and you just simply don't want them to ever come close to it. And by all means, keep it away from the children. There's far too many cases of a toddler shooting their parent or themselves or a sibling because they were rifling around in mom's handbag or found it in a nightstand or something like that. There's far too many cases of that in this country, of accidental handgun deaths.
Yeah.
Way too many.
And that would be eliminated by more usage of gun clubs.
Yeah.
Something that European countries have been doing for decades. Yeah.
Now, of course, also I must again talk to the people that are currently yelling at me. Because I can sense it. I know when it's happening. And yes, you should always practice gun safety and have your gun with a trigger lock. I know that. You should do that. Because then it keeps it out of the hands of the children. But there's also many people out there that find that would then prevent them from getting to the gun in a timely fashion because they need it in an emergency. So there's an argument on both sides. And they're both wrong because you don't need it, really.
I don't know if it's for someone, Mom of Van, where you have to, you can own the firearm, but the ammo stays at the club or range. I'm uncertain.
It is Switzerland that restricts. They can have a gun. In fact, I believe they have to have a gun, but they are not allowed to own ammunition. Like they have to have a 2-year service in the military, so they all get a gun. They all know how to use it, but they're not allowed to own ammunition. If you want to shoot the gun, you have to go to the range and you have to buy the ammo there, and you have to use it all there.
Or, I'm fine with that.
Or for hunting, yeah. Yeah, so I remember that as well. Before I go on another ranty rant, the federal assault weapon ban of 93, the ban including on this ban of magazines capable of holding more than 10 rounds of ammunition, became defunct, as in it expired, in September of 2004 per a sunset provision in the law.
Which, why was that even put in there?
Exactly. Attempts to renew the ban have failed on the federal level, time and time again.
Why put... I'm sorry. Sunset provisions are designed for very specific kinds of laws.
Mm-hmm.
Gun control laws are not one of them.
No, because at no point would that no longer be an issue. yeah, it's there's Canada. With the passage of Bill C-17 in 1993 under Prime Minister Kim Campbell, in response to a 1989 École Polytechnique massacre, magazines designed for use in semi-automatic centerfire rifles and semi-automatic shotguns became limited to 5 rounds, and magazines designed for use in handguns are limited to 10 rounds. Semi-automatic rimfire rifles, as well as manually operated long arms, are exempt from the magazine capacity restrictions, probably because they just take longer to use. Though semi-automatic rimfire rifles, I don't know. Not sure about that one. In recent years, there's been a growing trend of ways to legally work around the magazine capacity restrictions. Numerous semi-automatic centerfire rifles also happen to accept handgun magazines, thereby legally increasing magazine capacity. Numerous rifle and handgun magazines designed for this caliber also happen to fit an over-the-limit number of smaller caliber rounds, also legally increasing magazine capacity. So, yeah,
That's
another way around it, another way around it, you know. Do you have...
And that is specifically the gun manufacturers designing things to get around the law.
Yeah.
For marketing purposes.
In December 2013, the National Rifles Association, representing 5 residents in Sunnyvale, California, filed a lawsuit to stop enforcement of the city's ban on possession of magazines able to hold more than 10 rounds. In a case known as Fjok versus Sunnyvale in March 2014, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy rejected a request to block enforcement of the law pending appeals. In March 2015, the Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the magazine capacity restriction, ruling that it does not violate the Second Amendment. Yay!
Did something right.
Yeah, so California has stricter laws than pretty much any state in the union.
I think the strictest is probably New York City, but I can easily be corrected.
By a state, you know, though New York City has enough population alone to be counted as a state if we wanted.
I think it has a higher population than some of our states.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. Delaware.
I was thinking Rhode Island.
Okay. Yeah. Well, It's but a Google search away, so we could find that out if we really wanted to. Now, before we get into...
I think Steve should be next, especially since he's cut down for time.
Well, yeah, but I've got... I'll leave that for the very end. Well, maybe not. I don't know. There's a BuzzFeed video by one of their editors that is... it expresses a lot of emotion that I, being mostly Vulcan, am unable to adequately express. And I wanted to share it with everyone. So let me see if I can bring that up here.
On June 12, 2016, I woke up like any other Sunday morning and, like any other millennial, instinctively checked my phone. I immediately saw 2 words splashed across news outlets and social media: Orlando and shooting. My first thought was, oh, it must be about the shooting that happened last week. So I shrugged, wrapped a rainbow handkerchief around my neck, and traversed the few blocks that separated my apartment from the start of the Los Angeles Pride Parade. It was then and there, surrounded by a sea of fellow LGBTQ marchers, surrounded by family, that it became common knowledge that a very similar celebratory crowd of vibrant young people had just hours before been gunned down at Pulse Nightclub in what would be called the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. I realized throughout the following week, as my friends posted eulogies for victims who they knew in the massacre, that the degrees of separation between these events and me don't exist anymore. In fact, I wondered if they ever existed at all. And it dawned on me that the longest, most influential relationship I never knew I had in my life is with mass shootings. These tragedies have been brutally effective in shaping my worldview. So I don't want to speak on this topic as some self-purported expert like you'll see flooding your feeds, but from more of a sincere experiential perspective, I can remember exactly where I was and what I was doing for every major massacre in my lifetime. And more often than not, the victims and the perpetrators were around my age. I am stuck in a cyclical pattern of abuse in this relationship, but it wasn't always like this, and it has gotten much, much worse. When I was 5 years old, a man crashed his pickup truck into a chain restaurant called Luby's about an hour and a half from where I lived and shot and killed over 20 people. My father, to calm my fears, recounted an infamous school shooting that had happened in the 1960s as we drove past the clock tower at the University of Texas. He pointed at it and reassured me that was the last time something bad like this happened around here. These things don't happen often, so don't be scared. Little did he know, at the time, that he had only lived through around 20 U.S. mass shootings before I was born. By today, I've lived through over 100 and counting, and it all began at Columbine. I was 13 years old, and I can vividly remember sitting in front of my television set in my living room and watching the news replay the scenes of countless students running out of the school with their hands on their heads. Teenagers my age were dangling from broken windows, trying to escape. Columbine changed everything. And as the adults argued politics, we kids actually went through a massive tonal shift when it came to our perspective on our peers and our culture and security, and that's when I grew paranoid. Because our parents had wars and we had Columbine. I remember schools installing metal detectors at their entrances, and I remember that it became a common, sick, practical joke for some idiot to call a bomb threat just to watch everyone get evacuated. I remember rock music and video games and even the internet being blamed, and if you wore a trench coat, you were a killer. We were very quick and eager to turn on one another. Everyone debated about who or what was at fault. And if history has taught us anything, there was no easy answer. Kids were dead, and nothing was done. And then 9/11 happened, and our generation went from cautiously skeptical to absolutely terrified. Columbine ignited our fear as young citizens, then 9/11 defined it to be rampant, righteous, and unending. And why not? We were scared. We wanted answers, but instead of reaching for a common goal, we split ourselves in two. And every conversation you have, every fight online you'll see in the comments below, and every election year we witness this endless back and forth as more people die and less resolutions are reached. Years later, while I was attending film school at the University of Southern California, I was 2 weeks away from publicly premiering a short film, which had already wrapped, when the deadliest attack at that time happened on the opposite coast, on a campus much like mine. And in some twisted sense of timeliness, my short film was a graphic critique of school shootings. I remember mother of one of my friends walked up to me and remarked, "You should watch what you make since it looks like your kind are prone to violence." Virginia Tech, like any other massacre involving a wide array of players from different backgrounds, whether it was racial, religious, or cultural, brought forth an ugliness that directly affected me for the first time. And as we mourn the dead, it struck me that every time that this happens, it not only opens up an opportunity to advance personal and political agendas, becomes top priority for most of us to do so. And yet again, kids were dead, nothing was done. Of Omaha, Binghamton, Fort Hood, twice. Fort Hood, in the same town as that Luby's cafeteria that was shot up in my childhood. Schools, malls, churches, post offices, military bases, a grocery store, parking lot in Tucson. And then, a movie theater in Aurora, during a midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises. Where was I? Waiting to attend a midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises. We all could have been those victims, excitedly waiting to watch a blockbuster on opening night. No one was safe. And then later that year, over 20 people, the majority being children who were in the first grade, were shot and killed at Sandy Hook. Our little brothers and sisters, our own children, gunned down. My gut reaction was, well, now things will definitely have to change. But it did not. Little kids were dead, and nothing was done. Santa Monica, Santa Barbara, Marysville, Umpqua, Charleston. I apologize if I'm forgetting some, but there's just too many to count. So many that I, becoming so used to turning from passionate rage to desensitized resignation on a dime, I only shrugged. I screamed, and then I shrugged, and then I forgot. Our interconnectedness, not only as a nation, but also as an international community, the internet, social media, and bullet holes are like the connected dots that link our generation beyond each other's shores. Paris, my second home, where my mother has lived for over 17 years, was hit by a series of unfathomable terrorist attacks. And my immediate bleak thought was, my mother is dead. Thankfully, she was unharmed, but we have come to such a low point as a global society where we assume the absolute worst because it's how we already view one another as human beings. And then less than a month later, San Bernardino happened, and my mother returned the favor and had to call me to see if I was okay. Our entire office on Sunset Boulevard heard the sirens driving eastward to San Bernardino, less than an hour away. And in the following week, we'd hold a security meeting on what to do in an active shooter situation. What was once video games and trench coats has morphed into the red flag du jour for politicians who have ensured, especially with our upcoming election, that we are a country solely operating on our fear. We have let the politicians and talking heads and online forums dictate a conversation that our generation needs to have about our role in the fight against violence. We grew up on these mass shootings. The victims, and unfortunately the shooters, are people we all personally know. Orlando provided a spotlight on a real issue. This disconnect between those who write the narrative and those who are actually living it. Most of our leaders are not what the victims were, primarily LGBTQ, Latinx, Black, and young. In fact, many, many a politician aim to marginalize those groups today. We are passionate and overeducated, but desensitized and underrepresented, and thus we have become divided, just like the generations before us. But instead, we need to consider shutting the fuck up for a second and actually doing something about it. The patrons of Pulse were targeted because of who they were. They were queer people of color, and you as millennials out there all know and love someone from those backgrounds, and not all politicians do. It's fine to share their speeches and your opinions, even about this very video, but posting in the infinite soapbox that is the internet is like prayer without action. Contact your elected officials, because eventually we're going to become those elected officials. So merely shrugging at politics instead of actively participating in it will not change the game. Let's get up all in their business, because if Orlando has taught us anything, it's that they need to know that we cannot watch any more of our friends and loved ones die. And I'll be damned if kids who are watching this right now will grow up to become another statistic because we blindly join a system that loves to argue about problems but refuses to produce actual results. Mass shootings, they have been my longest, most influential relationship. Yes, but from this moment on, it will be I who defines it. When I look back on June 12, 2016, I will not only remember the deaths of the innocent, but what we did to finally make a change. And finally, to the LGBT community, know that you are brave and that you are strong and loved and that we are with you.
So, yeah, I had to share that.
Yeah. And that was necessary.
On June 12th, 2016...
No, I don't want to do it again. Can't do that one again, folks. That was hard. Okay. So, at this point, I'm going to let one of our other friends chime in, and then I'm going to, you know, blow my nose and regain composure, because that's a necessary thing, too. I think Stephen needs to chime in here.
Analysis would be good.
Yeah, he's quite good at that. And that is not the window that I need. There we go. Silly overlays all over the place. Come on. All I want to do is hit play. And there.
I've heard a lot out there, and this has been an argument that has gone on for years, about, you know, banning assault weapons, and then the question always comes about is, what is an assault weapon? Is it just simply the looks? Is it how it has that pistol grip, or that barrel shroud, or anything like that? And then that is actually a valid argument to have. So, and while the United States government, the federal government, has some restrictions, it is mostly left up to the states as to what the actual definition of an assault weapon is. So, being as complicated as it is, I decided, let's go ahead, take a look, and break it down quickly as to, I don't have numbers, but I came up with categories. Categories that we can use to classify what an assault weapon is. And I've got five here. If any of you out there who are listening in Netlandia, who are wonderful listening to this program, or see this video on YouTube, go ahead and either in the comments there, or more importantly, actually send me an email. It's Stephen, Stephen, at orellyradio.com. That's orellyradio.com. I'll get it. We'll have a discussion, and I may add it to this list. But for classification for assault weapons, what I have is the things that are important are muzzle velocity. How fast is the round traveling when it leaves the barrel? Important thing for penetration, for general deadliness as well. Second, length of the barrel. Again, pistol versus rifle versus everything else. Third, capacity. How many rounds can the thing fire? Or how many rounds can it hold, I should say. Because then, yeah, size of the round. This one I'm half on, half off. But again, smaller rounds that travel at lower velocity, less likely to kill versus a larger round traveling at higher velocity. Then you've got rate of fire. This is, I think, the key, absolute key position, because it's, again, one person with a bolt-action rifle versus one person with a semi-automatic. completely different category, completely different situation occurs. And I think that's the key defining factor when it comes to classifying an assault weapon. It can be the overriding term for all of them. As in, you know, somebody with a 50 caliber rifle that is a bolt action rifle that can hold one shot at a time. Okay, while it's a 50 cal, yes, it is going to be able to do essentially less damage than a lower caliber weapon that is able to hold a lot more and fire a lot faster. Things that would not be classified on this list, things that you could get access to no matter what, in my view, because, again, the main key being rate of fire. Bolt action rifles, absolutely, sure. Use them for hunting, use them for all that. Excellent, go for it. Pump action weapons, such as shotguns, absolutely, go ahead, go for it. Home defense, you want to use one? Beautiful. Lever action, of course, again, getting to slower rate of fire. And revolvers. Again, you have 5, maybe 6 shots total, and most people are not going to be able to do the Old West style fan the hammer trick. People will sometimes also bring up the idea of like full auto weapons. Those are in a complete category unto themselves, and we're not even worrying about that, considering that most times full auto weapons are not used in mass shootings. They tend to be semi-automatic weapons with large magazines. Again, I've got no numbers here yet, but please talk about this. Contribute. Write me about it. I'd love to hear your comments and your thoughts. You know, what is the appropriate barrel length for something to be considered an assault weapon versus not? Size of round, rate of fire, etc. I look forward to hearing about you, and I look forward to hearing about you guys discussing this on the show.
Yeah. So he makes a ton of good points there.
And a ton of legal points.
Yes. Now, I wanted to... I saw something a bit frightening, and it was a guy that shows just how easy it is to hide an AR-15 in his pants, along with like 6 30-round clips.
That's ridiculous.
So let me see if I can share this window. I was doing a quick search. Let's see here. There you go. Okay. So let me see if I can actually get the video to play. There we go. He's walking around. Walks a little bit with a limp.
A little stiff.
And he pulls out a full assault rifle with foldable front handle. And there's a clip. Pops it. Grabs another one out of his pocket. Fumbles with it. Okay, loaded. Okay.
Drops the clip.
Drops the clip. Grabs another one from his pocket. Pops that one in. That's the third clip. Drops it.
Drops it.
Grabs another one out of his pocket. That's 4 clips. And 5. And on to 6. Now he's just wearing jeans.
Yeah,
that's the 7th clip.
Literally... a ratty t-shirt and some jeans.
And then...
a ratty polo shirt.
And then he pulls out a handgun.
A handgun.
And drops one clip. Grabs another clip. 3 clips.
264
rounds. 264 rounds.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I thought that was germane to the conversation. To think that, well, you'd see. Nobody can pull that much ammunition. I mean, you'd have to have a belt and you'd have to have, you know, all that. No, no. I mean, this guy, the way he's dressed.
And he's slim.
Slim guy. You know, he could very easily, in fact, that probably works to his advantage. because, you know, you can have a shirt that's just slightly baggy, hangs a little bit there. You know, yeah, sure. I mean,
and no heavy clothing. Just something you could see somebody in Florida wearing.
Yeah.
Is a slightly ratty polo and jeans.
Yep, there. I'm showing the pictures, so if you're just listening to this, you need to go and you need to actually go check out the YouTube. We've got it there. So he's
white,
got
I want to say maybe 30s-ish.
Millennial.
Gentleman.
Yeah, a millennial. An older millennial. He does have a beard, but that doesn't really make any difference.
Big beard, but no. Relatively just, he's not exorbitantly fit, but he's not fat.
Nope.
He's just average. He's standard average white guy. Jeans and a polo. And he pulls out this AR-15, six clips, then a handgun and three clips.
To be fair, there was one already in the gun, so he had two extra clips.
And it wasn't that hard to switch once he pulled out the weapon. The thing is, to loosen that weapon, all you need to do is find a dark corner.
Oh yeah,
and no one will know.
Go to the bathroom.
Not even.
Yeah, I know.
Even
but
in a dark club, all you have to do is turn yourself towards a corner where no one is.
Yeah.
Or if you're in a club, you could be in a booth. You could be in a booth and pull that off. I've also been in bars where, no, you head towards the bathroom. You don't even need to go into the bathrooms. There's like this little antechamber. If no one's there, you're in the clear.
Yeah. So, it is always possible. And the laws already exist. The things that people do with these weapons are already illegal. We agree to that. The thing is that we need to pull them out of their hands. You know, how do you get them out of the hands of the bad people and still let the good people have them? And in an active shooter situation, how do you know who the good guy is versus the bad guy? We do not have video game natural discrimination where you can't hit the good guy, but you can always hit the bad guy, and you always know who's on your team. If you've got a gun, you're going to get shot. So open carry, yeah, absolutely. That's just going to get you killed by the good guys.
And more than anything, just coming from having family in law enforcement, it takes extensive training.
And constant.
To be able to accurately fire a weapon in a high-stress situation. And even then, that's not a guarantee. My dad had associates on the force who barely passed their firearms tests on a regular basis. And when in an active shooting, couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. My dad worked a number of police-involved shootings where the officer's shots were almost as wide as a barn. Just couldn't hit it.
That does not instill me with a great deal of confidence.
Okay. In where I grew up in South Florida, one of the last things I remember before I left to come to Orlando for college was there was this shooting that happened down Okeechobee Boulevard, which runs almost the entire length of the county of Palm Beach County. It started almost at one end and ended right at the intersection that I took on a daily basis to go to school. Overall, fire, just rounds used. And this was hypothesized because they couldn't find all of them. 600 rounds. It was a car chase. My dad on his retirement party got a giant blown up picture of when he was working the vehicle that the bad guys used. And when you're doing anything with a vehicle and bullets to understand trajectory, they use these little like neon yellow rods.
And
he and his friend thought it would be hilarious to put on Native American headdresses and stand next to this thing because it looked like it was shot full of arrows.
It's in poor taste, but I can see the joke.
But, yeah. No, that's one of the most distinctive memories I have when it comes to firearms and shootings. 600 rounds. And
this everybody
involved
on screen.
In the shooting lived because no one could hit anything.
Oh, jeez. Currently on screen is the Sig Sauer MCX, which is the gun that was used in Orlando.
Why would you need this?
It is a very light-framed weapon. Modular components, top rail, bottom rail. At least I think it's got a bottom rail. Folding rear stock, it would appear.
It's very modular looking.
And it has a, looks like it has a barrel suppressor, at least optional. Basic pistol grip. You know, it's a hybrid weapon.
And a folding stock, it looks like.
Yeah. It was, according to this article, which is out on Daily Mail, the Sig Sauer MCX was designed to meet U.S. military requirements for a small, quiet combat rifle for use in close quarters. The semi-automatic rifle hit the market in 2015 after years of development by Newington, a New Hampshire-based company which advertises it as a, quote, innovative weapon system built around a battle-proven core. This is...
a weapon designed military use.
Yeah. It comes with magazines that carry 30 rounds, is exactly the type of assault weapon that should not be available to citizens. It's light, and the ability to be fired and reloaded quickly make it an ideal gun to carry out an attack in a crowded place. Josh Sugarman says, this is a flagrant and grotesque example of how weapons designed for the battlefield are sold to the civilian population in the United States. He is the executive director of the Violence Policy Center, which issued a report on the weapon. He noted the gun features a folding collapsible stock that can make it smaller and a forward hand grip that allows users to repeatedly fire without burning their hands. The reason that shooters use weapons like this is because this is exactly what they were designed for.
These are weapons designed to kill on a field of battle.
In close quarters, this is designed for Saluja. This is designed for room-to-room, close quarters... plenty of rounds to do your job with limited reload time in between. To take out as many hostiles as possible.
This is a military weapon. Why can civilians get this?
Yeah. This should be within that Title II restriction, at least.
Now, are you saying you'd like them to expand Title II? Or should we come up with a new
title? I think that would be... that'd be an expedient route to go with it. Not that, you know, it would necessarily close any loopholes. You know, people that have the right permitting would still be able to get them. But at least if they have permits, then there's a record that they have them. And if they're titled to, they have to make those records have to be kept up to date. At least I think they do.
Again,
because a weapon in Title II wouldn't just be able to be sold at a gun show.
One would hope. But
unless you have a collector's permit. And then, again, if you have a collector's permit, you know, for relics and collectibles, then you're going to have paperwork.
You're going to be on file.
Yeah.
But
it might just be that simple. If it is this classification of weapon, and then we get into the definitions again.
And what the definitions are, and as Steve put, like, mm-hmm. what are our legal definitions for an assault weapon? What's the minimum barrel length? What's the minimum muzzle velocity? What's the minimum rate of fire?
Would you say that this weapon would be good to go out hunting, like boar or deer? Would this be an appropriate weapon for that?
No.
The barrel is not long enough. This is for small room incursions. If you're hunting, you want range. Wouldn't you? I would. I mean, I've already gone on the record saying that I'm essentially a pacifist in this. But if I was going out there and, you know, okay, I'm playing Oregon Trail. To avoid dying of dysentery and all that, I need to go out and I need to hunt, and I'm going to bring out my gun. I want some range between me and whatever I'm shooting at. I want it to be accurate at range. It does have a fairly long barrel, so it's going to get there. But it's not designed for that kind of thing.
No, this is a room sweeper. This is something that you can take and clear a room with.
Yeah.
That is what that weapon is designed to do.
I mean, I'd love to have somebody on that could discuss this rationally and calmly about why this weapon really would be appropriate
for hunting.
Now I do have a friend, and he teaches gun safety and all that, so he's invested in this industry, and he's also, you know, a Marine, former Marine. You know who you are. If you're listening to this, you know who you are. And he has said that these weapons are exceptionally good for home defense because of the same reasons why they're exceptionally good for an incursion into a home. Because they're maneuverable, you know, you can use them inside. And with a suppressor, it won't kill your ears. Yeah, those are good arguments. But at the same time, why?
Going in an entirely off-kilter direction, and one of my father's other cases,
mm-hmm.
a hunter came back from a hunting trip and found that his door was unlocked. And he heard rummaging sounds inside his home. So he took out his weapon from the car and encountered two individuals who were armed in the process of robbing his home. And quickly and efficiently, he defended himself, and both those individuals died. The weapon in question was a bow and arrow. Those gentlemen both were armed with handguns.
That is not a altercation that I would particularly choose to be in.
Professional hunter versus two guys that wanted to rob the joint. Well, not even rob, burgle.
Yeah. That's interesting, though. I could see that as they were involved, not on the lookout. They had already cleared the house.
But they were still armed, and they had guns in hand.
Yeah. Or at least they did, you know, when they probably died.
Yeah. Promptly, quietly.
Mom Van says, I can use a 410 shotgun for home protection as well. And yes, I think a shotgun is a far more appropriate weapon for home defense.
And you can load it with rock salt.
Yeah, that's going to hurt like a bitch, too.
You don't need some, like, dragon fire rounds or any of this other crazy nonsense.
A well-placed shotgun blast is quite effective. And, of course, you can load them with slugs, you can load them with birdshot, you've got some options there with a shotgun,
also,
and you never know what it's loaded with.
Of a pump action firearm chambering around usually gets somebody to stop what they're doing.
Yeah. It's a good solid Hollywood sound that is firmly embedded in our subconscious at this point.
No. For home defense, again, I can understand having a shotgun. Personally, I'm still a fan of the Louisville Slugger. That's just me. I don't have to worry about edge alignment, and I don't have to worry about, you know, somebody going off, rummaging around my things, and accidentally killing themselves or somebody I care about with my Louisville Slugger. If you're killing somebody with a Louisville Slugger, it's purposeful.
Hey, Mama Van, are you aware that there's a 410 shotgun pistol?
Now my head hurts.
Yeah, that's not so good. But yeah, shotguns. That, you know, I am on so many watch lists at this point because of my search history for this show. Yeah, just if they're coming to take me away, I hope that they actually subscribe to the show. And you should do that too.
Hear that, NSA? Subscribe.
Subscribe to the show. You know, I know that you're already downloading it because that's what you do. But, you know, you can at least make my numbers better. Okay. All right. Let's hear from David so that we can wrap this up and then get on to other fun things, such as they are.
Oh.
All right. Here he goes.
Brace yourselves, ladies and gentlemen.
He's a little low, too, so I got to pipe him up. Here we go.
Hey, oh, really radio. David here, and I hope that you are ready for me to go full Alex Jones, because I'm about to go full Alex Jones. And I don't mean just regular run-of-the-mill Alex Jones. I mean put on your captain's tri-mast tinfoil hat with embroidered stitching on the edges that has been just stamped into the metal. We're going all the way onto the crazy train / boat / plane. So, all aboard. Now, let's talk about the Trump presidency as a whole. When the thing started, there was this outcry from the right wing that the Trump candidacy was a right-wing conspiracy to derail the political process and make sure that Hillary is the winner. And if you look at things as they stand today, Trump has totally derailed the right-wing primary process, and the end result of this is that most likely Hillary's just gonna destroy him in the actual election. Now, let's review things from a right-wing perspective, which is a difficult perspective to go to if you're a liberal. But here's
you know, I think that this was for a different show.
It may very well have been.
This might be for a different show that I did not get a chance to actually use. Which is sad because it was the only one that I could find, and I thought it was current. Huh.
Oh, kerfuffle.
Yeah, this...
We see you.
Here's our error. Kerfuffle the owl shows his head. Okay, should we continue to hear him out on his, on his crazy train?
I don't know. I kind of want the crazy train to be for, you know, our break, or is the crazy train just too short?
It's not very long. There's 4 more minutes of this.
4?
Yeah, it's a 5-minute clip, yeah. That was a minute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was a whole minute. You want to keep going?
Sure. Let the bullet's already out of the gun.
Let's see what it strikes. Here we go.
Here's the lens you need to look at things through. Number one, you look at the world through a sense of fear. Everything is fear. Everyone's out to get you. It's scary out there. And number two, your primary goal in life is to ensure your own survival, regardless of who you have to step on to get there. Now, with that said, if you look at Trump and what's going on with him right now, there are several federal investigations into this guy. Criminal investigations are going on into several of his business ventures. He has a long run. Long-standing run of beating people out of money who have invested in various Trump properties around the world. Trump University is being called a sham and a scam, and there might be criminal charges based off of that. The Department of Labor has just announced an investigation into Trump over wage theft. So there, things are not looking so good for Trump. And as a right-wing thinking individual and somebody who has lived the Republican lifestyle all of his life, he's looking at this and going, I have got to do something about all the charges that are going against me. I've got to do something about my future before the world really does get me this time. I'm going to pull a fast one on the world. And so let's go back to one of the debates where people asked him, hey, you've given money to Hillary Clinton. What has she done for you? Give us an example. And he talked about how Hillary went to his wedding because she had to, because he had given her money for her political campaigning. Now, given that lens to work off of, if you look into this whole presidential election as instead of a monetary payment, it's a different kind of payment. This is a huge favor. I make it so that I win the primary for the Republican National Convention, and there's no way, as the quintessential Republican Tea Party candidate, that I can get any moderate votes. I make sure that there's no way in hell or heaven or with the grace of God behind him all the way that he can actually win the election. And in the event that the Republicans decide to overthrow him and overcome the will of the Tea Party, which has boosted him to power, they split the vote because he just keeps running anyway. And she wins even bigger than if he runs with their full backing. So if you look at this whole thing as just one gigantic favor to who is going to become the most powerful person in the land, and you call in that favor right away to say, you see all this litigation against me? Make it go away. Maybe under the lens of fear and I got to do what's good for me and nobody else and I don't care what happens to the rest of the world. If you look at that as the quintessential Republican view, and you look at what's going on with Trump, and you look at this election cycle, which he has no chance of winning, maybe, just maybe, it makes a little bit of sense. It's crazy? Yeah, it's crazy. And when pitched to anyone who has some semblance of sanity, yes, the answer is, nah, that could never happen. But Washington works off of favors. You scratch my back, I scratch your back. What if this is just a big one? Think about it.
I hate to say it, but I have thought about that.
I haven't, because at this point, the Republican establishment's falling in line behind him. Because they want a Republican in power.
Yeah, well,
if it's Trump.
They have little option at this point.
And I mean, what better way to get out of litigation than be the most powerful in the land?
Yeah, it's such a long way to go for it.
But he's got this groundswell. Pretty much every ugly American that we've got is coming out of the woodwork and backing this guy.
Yeah. I think that people that underestimate him
would be far more contentious than people are giving it credit.
I think people that are underestimating him, thinking that is completely impossible, have vastly underestimated the racism in this country.
Again,
vastly.
Not just racism.
Well, yeah, bigotry, hate, fear, you know.
Yeah, but you also have to think about this twisted self-interest.
He did you see the articles that came out this week about how his campaign's so busted broke that, and throughout the history so far, that his campaign has basically spent $6 million at Trump properties?
Yeah. I saw the article.
Yeah.
Again, everything that people who have known Trump have said about him, he's not an idiot. He may have outlandish ideas, but he's no fool.
Yeah.
He's used bankruptcy law to his advantage. He uses the law in governments outside of our own to his benefit.
And of course, and why wouldn't
he's going to use this election to his benefit. Yeah. Whether he wins or loses, this is an investment by somebody who is just absolutely ruthless.
Yeah. It's insane. It's absolutely
insane. He's going to make a profit off of this.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Of course he will, yeah.
This is a no-lose situation for him. Because if he loses the election, he's still got all that free press for all of his new properties, all the stuff that he's doing, and his kids have made a giant profit off of this. Plus, possibly establishing future campaigns for his kids, because they will look more moderate.
Oh God!
Compared to him,
I did
but
see.
Will have the Trump recognition of the name.
Yeah, I did see a possibility that he was going to name like one of his sons as his VP.
Doubtful.
Oh yeah, it's doubtful. He has to play favorites, you know, and he has to play politics if he wants anything like that. But
no, yeah. this is a no lose situation for the man.
Boy, I don't. Okay, I did not want to talk about Trump. Thanks, David. No, I don't know. That might be my fault. I was looking through. It's like, where is his post? I can't find it. I don't know where he sent it. So, well, we need to work on our organization. Apparently,
thanks, Kerfuffle.
Yeah. Anywho, it's getting close to midnight, and I have to take my girls fishing tomorrow morning.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, the Cape Canaveral, there's a big fishing expo for young people. So they'll get a free fishing pole and all this stuff, and they'll go fishing. They're like chumming the waters now to make sure that there's fish there for everybody to go. They're expecting, you know, like thousands of people. So it's going to be a big thing, and though I said that we were going to get to the Brexit, I feel that there's not enough information really to go over it.
Well, with the Brexit, it's really, right now, it's quick and dirty.
Yeah.
We can get details more, and we'll see the economic, you know,
Fallout
from all this next week, but right now, quick and dirty of it is...
Yep. So by the way, ladies and gentlemen, there will be no show 2. Okay. Yeah. We're going to do Brexit right now.
Yep.
And then we're done, and we'll see you next Friday with more aftermath. And we'll get into all the science that we didn't do this week, because there was plenty of stuff. And there's certainly a lot going on in the Supreme Court that definitely warrants talking about. But can't do it. Can't do it. Oh, there's Steven. Hi, Steven.
He's quick and dirty Brexit.
Yep.
English nationalism won. So the UK is out of the EU. The current Prime Minister, David Cameron, has stepped down.
Well, isn't it a referendum? So they're not technically out yet?
They're not out yet, but they are leaving. Oh, they are, but by how right now I'm understanding everything. They are leaving. There will be a new prime minister ensconced by October. Right now the pound is at the lowest value it's ever been in its history since tracking this stuff.
Yeah.
There is, right now we're experiencing an economic fallout. All markets are in flux because of this. Just the announcement just today on the 24th, while the decision was made on the 23rd.
Well, it was late on the 23rd, so yeah, the 24th has been fallout for it.
The more conservative nationalistic members of the government are giddy. There is threats from rebels from Scotland yet again, but this time, ooh, it might actually happen, of Scotland leaving the UK.
Yeah, Scotland was pretty much, you know, in the grand map of where the votes were coming in. Scotland, as a solid block, said, we want to stay in the EU.
Yeah. There's also been rumblings that from some Irish nationalists that are going, hey, we'll take our little brother back. We'll have a United Ireland now, thank you, and we'll join the EU once we get our little brother back and be a whole island. There has been rumblings of that too. So it may end up with a Britain that looks like just England and Wales and its territories.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. Which, the removal of Scotland is the removal of their production power. Just to let you know.
Yeah.
That's where all the oil is. That's where most things are made and exported from. So, yeah, that's a thing. It was also a very close, contentious race, though the sad note, but very relevant note, is that before the assassination of the British MP, Jo Kelly, I believe was her name.
I know.
It was being predicted that the outcome was going to be an exit, but it was going to be a double-digit margin. The assassination actually pushed the vote closer.
Interesting.
So it was only a 2-point at the end of this race. 2-point. Oh, Joe Cox. Thank you, Mama Van. Joe Cox was the MP who was assassinated. Mm-hmm. That pushed the vote closer to being 52 for leaving the EU, 48 for staying.
It's kind of ugly. I was looking, trying to find some things, and there's an article out on Medium done by Hugh Hancock, who founded Makama.com, online filmmaking pioneer for 18 years. So that I fact-checking the Brexit, the conclusion, you know, I've spent the last 3 weeks fact-checking every detail on Brexit that I possibly could. I've read 90-page document, government reports on my way to my wedding, way to a wedding, not his wedding. I've hacked through academic analysis on the EU when I really should have been promoting my virtual reality game. I've treated myself to a fun Google search on the accounts of pro-Remain activists to check that they are not biased, and so on. And there's a whole mess of posts, and it's been surprisingly interesting in some ways and frustrating in others, but that's not what you care about. You care about who's telling the truth, who isn't, and who you should vote for. Of course, this was right before. As with many things, we find out so many things after the fact, hindsight being what it is. They came into basically the folks that are saying stay in the EU are more fact-based in all of their arguments, and those that wanted to leave are, there's a lot of lies, absolute outright lies in the claims.
Oh, myriad.
Yeah. And
it's a rise in nationalism in response to a perceived immigrant threat. I was having a conversation just before the show with one of my friends who studies statistics. And she goes, "Hi, guys. Do you remember the early 20th century? Because we're experiencing it all over again." including the economic downturns and the rise in nationalism across the board.
Do you? Just Stephen saying, just like Germany after World War One. Yeah, I'd seen that he had made some rumblings about that earlier. And it's like, oh no, I see where you're pointing. No, we don't want that. Now the question is, do you become, which comes first, the downturn in the economy or the nationalism? I imagine usually it's the downturn in the economy.
The economy, yeah.
And but then you become more nationalistic.
But the nationalism has already been rumbling there. And we've already had an economic downturn. Because the downturn happened in 2000.
Maybe it's...
Maybe
they rise and fall together. You know, there's no way to really isolate it. It just all happens at the same time. Like a synergy, it occurs. Yeah.
And no, there's a new immigrant threat that is apparently affecting people's, you know, dollars at the end of the day, or at least the politicians can blame them as such. They're easily targeted.
Scapegoats.
Yeah. They wear a traditional dress which identifies them, as well as there are those that can be misconstrued due to their traditional dress being somewhat similar, at least in the eyes of the ignorant.
Sikhs, yeah.
Yeah. And no, it's those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it, and here we are again.
Yeah.
But this time with a more, even more global community.
A statement here. At every single turn, I found that the Leave campaign's arguments were founded on lies. Sorry, it's as simple as that. I wish it wasn't. They lie about how much money we spend on the EU. I'd love to say that they're misinformed or they exaggerate, but they don't. They lie outright. They lie about the business case for leaving. I still have found absolutely no support whatsoever for the figures that they are confidently quoting. They lie about the state of democracy in the EU. The more I investigate the EU, the more I find out it is fairer and better set up than the UK's government. Just today, I discovered that the European Commission's role in legislation is actually far more balanced than I thought. Now, all of these also have like bullet point links and things like that. I'm not going to bore you at this point because I want to wrap it up. and the Leave campaign lie a lot more. I haven't had time to post the mini fact checks that I've found. As just one example, the Vote Leave website claims, quote, "Because of the free movement laws, the UK cannot test every EU doctor operating in the UK for whether they can speak English." As proof, they link to an article in The Guardian about a horrible accident thanks to a doctor not understanding English. In that article, it explicitly states, quote, "The GMC, which registers doctors and licenses them to work, has been able to check EU medics' English since last summer." So just immediately
negating
that argument. In other words, Leave's statements is absolutely untrue. And that's proved by the article that they themselves use as proof of their untrue statement. Remains reliability. Every claim of theirs that this person checked, even the ones that had pro-Remain friends shouting about how over-the-top and ridiculous they were, has turned out to be more or less sound. Their arguments are evidence-based. The evidence is solid. Their backup studies are detailed and provide sources and reasoning. I could rarely pick any holes in their logic. Their studies tally with independent studies of the same things, and sometimes they're using independent studies rather than anything that they control. The worst I was able to prove was that at one point in a 90-page review seemed to lack backup evidence. And that's the same review whose conclusions almost all credible external sources agreed with. So even then, it still jibed with all the other external evidence.
Evidence.
The other side, absence of evidence. Lies, fabrications. And unfortunately, it's the lies and the fabrications that are winning out here, which means that there's going to be an awful lot of people that are going to be hurt by the truth.
Oh, yeah.
And hurt by the truth in a way that is amazing, in that the first most popular search result following the referendum vote was, what's a Brexit? This was in the UK. And the second most popular was, what's the EU?
Oh, good heavens.
What's the EU? The euro? Have you not heard of the euro? Do you not even know what that is?
Well, again, the euro is actually, in my experience, while the euro is used over in England, they still use the pound a lot more. It's more common.
Well, in England, yeah, it's pound sterling. That they rejected the euro. But still, the euro exists right there. Right there in their backyard. Because they can just, they can take the tunnel. They can take the train.
They can take the ferry over to Norway.
They can take a day trip to the mainland, as it were. They can do that.
And it's the sad thing is the economic impact that it has on port cities.
It's going to be major.
And England's a series of islands, folks. So there's a lot of ports. And most of those port cities have been getting money from the EU, not England, not the UK, the EU, for improvement, for economic help. And they're going to lose that now. If you want to do some homework on your own, go and research Cardiff, Wales. It is a port town in Wales that has been receiving EU money to improve the lives of its citizens.
Yeah. Now, so a lot of the there have been talks. You know, Mama Van stated is Trump running running Britain as well.
No.
And they're part of this of the Leave campaign, of the vote themselves out of the EU, was make Britain great again.
Yeah,
make England great again, which is a direct ripoff of Trump's line. So yeah, it matters. Now, of course, in Scotland, they raised the Mexican flag next to his golf course, Trump's golf course, and someone was pelting him with swastika painted golf balls earlier today. So yeah, there's not a lot of love for the Donald over there. And no. They were already voting to never let him step foot on their soil again.
There was not necessarily voting. What they did was they had they opened the lower chamber of parliament to have a debate on Trump. There was no resolution passed. There was just a lot of comments and chest thumping. And that was about it.
Yeah. One of the biggest criticisms is that Britain has no control over its borders, no criteria over what kind of people may enter and reside, nor any limit on their number.
That's all lies and slander, actually.
A lot of it is. But again, those are the talking points that are making it on their news, too.
So they have fantastic control of their borders. It's incredibly hard to immigrate to.
It's hard to immigrate to, but any any person that is a citizen of another nation that's in the EU has free transit. They can,
yeah,
they have free passage.
You have free transit. It's very much, but remember, the size of Europe versus the size of the US. Let's put things in perspective. All right, I'm going from France, i.e. Alabama.
Yeah.
To go over to the UK. I don't want
to... By the way, I don't think France would ever be like to be compared to Alabama.
Yeah, but going from Alabama to Georgia.
Proximity, yes.
Hi. I shouldn't necessarily have to go through customs if we're part of a confederation now, should I?
Yeah.
That's just sound reasoning, because we are in confederation, so there is a governing body above our states, or in this case, nation states.
Yeah. It's trusting the nations to police their people properly so that they're well vetted to travel.
Yeah. And it's a benefit for tourism, and it's a benefit for everyone's economy. By shutting things down, forcing people to go through customs, you are slowing travel, you are slowing economic commerce, as well as prosperity.
Yeah.
All for a sense of fear, and fear for no good reason.
Now, this is also going to have implications on what we discovered was the Trans-Pacific Partnerships, you know, Kid Sister, the TTIP, yeah. The Trans-Atlantic Investment Partnership.
That is the one silver lining when it comes to Britain, and they're That's leaving the EU.
Yeah.
Because if the EU adopts that, Britain doesn't have to.
Right. But then...
So they can enter their own specific trade agreements.
They can, but it's going to hurt Britain even more. Because then Britain's going to be not a part of that. And Stephen points out that 52% of their trade economy was into the EU. But I think it was actually closer to like 57%. It was more.
It really depends on what you're tracking.
Yeah, it vacillates in there. But it's more than half of their trade does go to the EU. We can safely say that.
It's right there. Easier to transport their product.
Yeah, it's right there. It makes sense.
You're not having to spend exorbitant amounts of money trying to ship it, let alone what tariffs that you're going to have to deal with when going to other countries.
Right.
Since you're in the EU, you have less tariffs on your trade because it's within the EU. Mm-hmm. So you're making more profit.
And now
good economic sense.
And now they've crapped on that. So just from a follow the money standpoint, this is a bad deal for them.
It is a bad deal for the common citizen of the UK. It is a great deal for those within the UK who already have money.
Is it?
Yes. Here is why.
Well, it'll hurt their businesses, though.
It'll hurt their businesses in the short term.
It's already hurt the value of their holdings. You know, because the stock market
plummeted.
It's hurt
across the board, but as we have learned, a lot of economies recover. And Britain's economy is fairly solid. People still want British goods.
Yeah.
People still are going to want British trade. And they're going to be able to dictate the terms of said trade better and more on their terms without having the EU meddling.
Mama Van just refuted your claim, saying England now has no bargaining power. They will be forced to take what they can get. I don't know that England has ever taken just the scraps at the dinner table.
No. There's such a demand for certain goods that only Britain produces, or Britain is a great producer of, one of them being military hardware, and they can now take that desire for British military hardware and renegotiate their terms without having to be governed by the EU's rules.
Yeah, weren't they responsible for the manufacture of the Joint Strike Fighter?
Yes, that was partly them. One of the things that they're more known for is actually a number of troop transports, personnel vehicles, and mine finders and destroyers. There's also tons of different British firearms there on the market.
Boy, it's a good thing that peace is never going to break out.
And other things that they do well, a lot of big construction vehicles, and these are vehicles that are used throughout Europe, as well as a lot of our nations, including India, are made in Britain.
Oh, and I saw a clever joke, from India. It's like, had we only known that all it would take is a vote to get people out of a country, to get Britain out of a country.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, India.
Not, nice burn, but considering how much they consume of British goods, they're going to need to negotiate with Britain and on the people who profit the most from that trade on their terms. Again, the people who can take the economic hit aren't harmed by this, and they're going to profit off.
Yeah, who
can't take the economic hit that are going to. It's going to be as bad as the Thatcher era was for the common citizen. It's going to be that bad, if not worse.
So, according to Google, just to be quick here, 100% reporting in the vote, remain a member of the European Union was 48.1%. With 16,141,241 reporting, voting. And leaving was 51.9% with 17,410,742 voting. Some of my friends over in Britain, they were saying that they were going to go to the pub and talk to people. And there were several people that they voted with their gut, that they just felt that leaving was a better idea, which is not the informed, worldly wise, financially sound decision to make.
No.
So what I really, 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 really am concerned about here is, what's the Queen going to do? She could veto it, couldn't she?
No, that's not how this works.
She can fire all of Parliament.
No, she can fire the head of Parliament.
I think she can remove all of them and have them all revoted. If she wanted to. She never has, but I believe that's part of her power.
She might be able to call for a vote. But, no, she's mostly there to appoint the head of the Church of England and to confirm the Prime Minister. That is her primary positions within their governmental structure. Now, she can refuse to confirm a prime minister, which she's never done, not to my knowledge. But that's the thing that she can really do if she's upset, is, oh, look, David Cameron stepped down because, well, he knows better. And they prop up some nationalistic conservative clown like Boris Johnson, and she goes, no, that's not going to be your prime minister.
Yeah, please stop, Boris. No, that'd be terrible.
The sad thing is, the man used to have a brain.
Yeah. He doesn't. But
something happened circa 2006. I don't know what.
One thing's for certain, this is going to take years to do because, you're already intermingled, so you have to be fairly invested in doing so.
Well, actually, the transition period that they're positing is 2 years to fully get untangled.
That was one posit. I think that's entirely too optimistic. Governments are not to move quickly when things like this are concerned. Thank you, Stephen, for posting the powers of the Queen of England. Royalcentral.co.uk blogs insight. What are the Queen's powers? Okay, It's good, good, good. Political powers. Summoning Parliament. The Queen has the power to suspend and summon Parliament. Prorogation typically happens at the end of parliamentary session, and the summoning occurs shortly after when the Queen attends the state opening at Parliament. Royal assent is the Queen's right to and responsibility to grant assent to bills from Parliament, signing them into law, whilst in theory she could decide to refuse assent. The last monarch to do this was Queen Anne in 1708, but it's still possible.
She could refuse the Brexit.
She could refuse it. It's like, no. This is, if it's bad for the country, she could say no. Secondary legislation. The Queen can create orders in council and letters patent and regulate parts to do with the crown, such as precedence, titles. Orders in council are often used by ministers nowadays to bring acts of Parliament into law. Appoint and remove ministers. That speaks for itself. Appoint the Prime Minister. The Queen is responsible for appointing the Prime Minister after a general election or a resignation. In general election, the Queen will appoint the candidate who is likely to have the most support of the House of Commons. In the event of a resignation, the Queen listens to advice on who should be appointed as their successor.
So they could try and carry Boris up, and she can just go, no.
No. She can also declare war. The sovereign retains the power to declare war against other nations, though in practice this is done by the Prime Minister and Parliament of the day. Freedom from prosecution under British law. The Queen is above the law and cannot be prosecuted. She is also free from civil action. I'm the Queen. Fuck off.
Pretty much.
Yeah. She has very limited judicial powers, and there is only one that she is used on a regular basis, with others having been delegated to judges in Parliament through time. That would be the royal pardon, which speaks enough, I believe. Oh, wait. It is now used to correct errors in sentencing and was recently used to give posthumous pardon to World War II codebreaker Alan Turing. So that's an interesting bit of trivia. Armed forces. She's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. She commissions officers and disposition of the forces, organization and disposition of the armed forces are part of the royal prerogative. The crown technically controls how the armed forces are used. Create peerages, fronts, font of honor. And miscellaneous. She can... Control of passports. The issuing and withdrawal of passports are within royal prerogative. This is used by ministers on behalf of the Queen. All British passports are issued in the Queen's name. And, of course, requisitioning ships. So, but yes, apparently, according to this...
She could say, no, the Brexit was a bad idea.
She can say, no. Shadow, you must be joking. So she, that may happen.
I doubt it will, because she hasn't exerted that power before.
However, she may do it to foster a legacy for her successor. It's possible. Yeah, you know, I can see reasons for her to do it beyond just protecting the kingdom.
But she has always proven to be very conservative in her views of her powers.
Yes. Oh, that's true, Mama Van. With no sitting prime minister, she may have a little more weight to throw around. Because she would be the prime minister in his absence, essentially. Until a new one is appointed.
Again, there's supposed to be individuals shortly should be coming out of the woodwork to throw their names into the ring.
Yes, but she has to bless them.
She essentially has to confirm whoever the group decides. And if they She can refuse to appoint who they want.
Yes.
Essentially, she has right of refusal when it comes to the Prime Minister.
She essentially has right of refusal on everything. That's essentially what I'm reading here.
But it has rarely been exerted, which has kept her beloved by the people, because she has let their choices stand.
Right. This would be interesting.
However wrong they may be.
I don't think that they've ever been this wrong before.
But it is the British people's mistake to make.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it also means losing Scotland. I mean, really.
That's the British people's mistake to make.
Yeah.
And I can tell you right now, because of just how poorly the pound has been affected, this is probably the greatest and most significant threat when it comes to Scotland leaving that they've ever faced. Because it's been close before. Now, I don't think it's going to be close.
What, now, wait, what do you mean in close?
There have been votes before for Scotland to leave the UK before, and they have been close. Many times the vote to stay has been like 56 to 44. That's sort of close.
Yes.
I see them leaving now. I honestly, if they actually go through with this nonsense, I can see Scotland, because Scotland has its own bank. They do maintain a bit of independence on their own economy. And remember, they are primarily the means of production for the entire UK. They would actually, by leaving the UK, be making more money. They have for economic reasons, just economic reasons, every reason at this point to leave. Okay. And not a single economic reason to stay.
The Scottish independence referendum in 2014, it was a 44 to 55 vote. 44.7 wanted to be independent, and 55.3 said remain under the crown.
Again, they have every economic reason to leave at this point. Part of the reason for staying with this past vote was they finally got some concessions from Parliament in when it comes to oil profit shares, which was a big contentious thing.
I find it interesting that the number of votes cast in the Scottish independence referendum was larger than the number of votes cast in the EU leave or stay.
Just for Scotland or as a whole?
Just for Scotland. Because it was the Scots that were voting for the Scottish independence referendum.
Yeah.
And 3,623,344 of them voted.
Yeah.
Less in all of the UK that voted on whether or not to stay or leave the EU. That's not a great voter turnout.
No. But also, it was a thing that was very ill-informed.
People don't know. There were people searching on what the EU even is.
Again, a lot of individuals, especially within Britain, have a more narrow view of life. They're more concerned with what happens to them locally than on the international stage. And so I'm not surprised that a vote would come up and pass them by.
It is a bit disturbing, though.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
This is a lesson, ladies and gentlemen. Stay informed politically, and by all means vote, but vote informed.
If you're going to vote, know what you're voting for. You know, be informed consent is really something that I try to strive for, you know, in everything. You know, same thing with religion. If you are going to follow a religion, you definitely need to know your holy book. You need to know all of that. Know what you're signing your eternal soul for. If you're going to be voting, know who you're voting for. Know what they're talking about.
Know what the content is. And by all means, what might as well be the catchphrase for this entire radio station, follow the money. Follow it. See who benefits financially from any one of these political decisions. Because those are the people who are trying to buy your vote.
Steven's a bad person, and he has shown a little the link that he dropped in the chat there. It's a tweet by Jacob, unpronounceable last name, saying, "I guess the EU now has 1 GB of free space." Oh, that's a terrible geeky joke. And with that, I think, honestly, I think we are done.
Done.
So, with a nice, long, unusual show with a lot of things that we don't usually talk about, this is it. That's it for this show. We'll be back live next Friday about 9:30 p.m. Eastern. There will be no show dropped on Wednesday because this is it. You got the whole thing. In the meantime, how about we continue this conversation on the web where it belongs, obviously. Head over to orellyradio.com. That's orellyradio.com for all the links right at the top of the page. So you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, Google+, subscribe to the YouTube and the Twitch channels, and of course, watch us live and join in the chat room. And, you know, keep up with what we're doing and change the direction of the show, make us laugh, make us cry, whatever you happen to have. If you've stayed with us this long, and why wouldn't you? Of course you would. Then how about you contribute to the show with ideas? You can send us an email at orellyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can send us a voicemail at 470-222-6759. We also take text messages there as well, and we will share them on the show. And we want your ideas. We want your feedback, and we want ideas for news articles, and of course, any criticism that you have, please lay it at our feet, because we do make mistakes, and we would like you to correct us whenever possible. Of course, also, this is free to you, but it's not free to me. So if we've entertained you, and you feel that you could give us a little scratch, we have a Patreon page, patreon.com/orellyradio, or you can leave a one-time donation on the donate button on our webpage. It's okay. If you can't fit us into your rainy day funds, you know what? We'll still be here next week. So with that, we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us tonight. Until next time, this has been Orelly Radio, part of the Cowan Services Network. Music for the show was created by Kevin McLeod of Incomptech.com, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.